For instance, when was the Jurassic era, the Triassic era? So I asked him one simple question. I said, what would happen if we found fossils, say a fossilized tree, that started somewhere maybe in the Carboniferous period and actually grew up through several different layers? He smiled, he looked at me, he said, that should never happen. I said, you're absolutely right. Because allegedly, each one of those layers is representing millions and millions of years. So if you've got a tree that started growing in the Carboniferous period, what happens if it dies? Well, it should just decay and rot, right? It shouldn't wait around millions of years while all of these other layers collect around it. I then shared with him some facts that I knew from a recent trip. My son and I, we went to Mount St. Helens in May of this year. Believe it or not, and I know some of you are not going to believe me, believe it or not, this year marked the 30th anniversary of that volcanic eruption. It's been 30 years ago this year. We went there for one purpose. We were filming a new DVD on topics of age of the earth. And I'll admit to you right up front, you know, I feel like I have a pretty good strong faith and have really examined a lot of the evidence. But this was a life-altering trip for me personally because I was seeing things, doing some research firsthand that absolutely just will blow your mind. Let me share with you a couple of the things that we found. In fact, if you look right here, there is at the Mount St. Helens what they're now calling the Mini Grand Canyon. Now, if you look very carefully at that particular picture, if we didn't know anything at all about the field of geography or geology, we could make the assumption that that river that you're seeing right there, that that carved that particular canyon over millions of years. And yet we know those canyons were formed in about 6 hours. And the reason we know that, if you look on the previous slide, when Mount St. Helens erupted, it didn't just go vertically like most volcanoes. It actually also exploded outwards, laterally. Right before it did that, a whole lot of snow slid down, was covered over, and then it was superheated with that lava. Now, what is snow going to do when it's superheated? It's going to melt quickly and produce steam. And it was the steam that actually blew out these canyons in just 6 hours of time. Now, here's the point I want you to think about as we go through these slides. Prior to Mount St. Helens, prior to 30 years ago, the entire field of geology was basically based on assumption. We had to make assumptions of how long did it take to make a canyon? How long does it take for those striatal layers to be laid down? How does all of this stuff work? And that's what they taught us. And then Mount St. Helens happened, and now we've got a living laboratory. It's the most studied volcano ever, period. We now have something that we can actually look at and know precisely how long it takes. This is a page out of a textbook. Notice what it says. Over millions of years, the Colorado River carved out the Grand Canyon from solid rock. That's what we've been told. And yet, you think about it for just a moment. Here's the fact that we know. We know that the Grand Canyon exists. The problem is we've got two different interpretations. We've got the evolutionists who say that it was formed very, very slowly, millions of years as that river slowly carved out the canyon. Creationists would say it was formed quickly by a lot of water over a little amount of time. The problem is evolutionists are wanting very badly to erase the line between fact and their interpretation. And that's what we see in textbooks. We see repeatedly over and over and over them blurring the line, basically saying that our interpretation is the fact. They say the Colorado River has cut through layer upon layer over millions of years. And yet, folks, now that we have Mount St. Helens, we know that there's a better explanation. Now think with me for just a moment. Do those textbooks actually talk about the physics of that river? Because if you look very carefully, the river enters the canyon right here at an elevation of 2,800 feet. 2,800 feet elevation. You realize it actually has to flow uphill. And by that I mean this. The top of the canyon is higher than the bottom. You say, what are you talking about, Brad? River only goes through the bottom. The top is higher than where the river enters the canyon by over 4,000 feet. Because right here, you've got a canyon rim that's elevation of 6,900 plus feet. It enters at 2,800. That would mean it's going uphill. Think about this too. There is no delta. So exactly where did all the stuff from the Grand Canyon go to? If the river really did carve out that canyon, we would expect there to be some kind of a delta. So maybe there's a better explanation. Maybe instead of a river over millions and millions of years, maybe it was a catastrophe over a very short amount of time. Here's what I mean by that. If you look on the screen behind me, you'll see striatal layers. Hopefully everybody can make them out pretty cleanly. The bluff that you're looking at right there is roughly about 120 feet. We actually filmed one of the segments right there. You'll notice there is sedimentary rock on top. There is layering below that. Now, again, geologists would say that that was carved out over time, millions of years, and that each one of those layers was laid down over millions of years. The only problem with that is we know precisely that particular bluff was laid down in approximately a year and a half. Because that's also at Mount St. Helens. In fact, if you look at this particular picture, they know from photographic evidence when each one of these particular layers was put down. You've got the major eruption that happened May 18th of 1980. You had a post-eruption June, and then a couple of years later, you had another post-eruption. Each time laying down these different layers. Now, how many of us have driven down the road, the interstate, and we see all these different layers cut into rock, and we look at that and we think, man, ooh, that looks old. And yet we now know that you can do that in a matter of days. Now, people always come up to me and they say, you know, Brad, but the rocks look so old. Folks, what does a young rock look like? Does it have a diaper on it? I mean, let's think about this for just a moment. So here we've got photographic proof of something which is quite literally causing us to rethink the whole way all of these things are put down. Now, let me give you one more thing to think about. While we were at Mount St. Helens, we took a helicopter. We flew over Spirit Lake. Spirit Lake is sitting on the northwest side of Mount St. Helens. When the volcano erupted, it put about 1 million trees into this lake. Believe it or not, there are roughly 30,000 of them still floating in a log mat on top of it today. One of the things that a friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Dr. Steve Austin, has actually witnessed firsthand is the fact that these logs, they will float for many, many, many years, and then they actually sink down and they'll bob upright on the top of Spirit Lake. We've seen them. We've got pictures of them. And then they settle to the bottom, standing up just like a forest. And he shared with me, he said, Brad, every time there's a new eruption, basically, you've got a new layer in Spirit Lake. Now, let's think about this for just a minute. According to evolutionists, each one of those layers you see behind me, the Grand Canyon, allegedly is put down over millions and millions of years. And yet, Steve Austin, if you look in this picture, you'll notice he is in a scuba gear. He and one of his colleagues at the bottom of the screen. They've dove down into Spirit Lake and they've documented the fact that what these trees are actually doing is this right here. And every time that that new lava dome blows a little bit, it settles more stuff on these floating logs. So you get this layering effect. That's what they see in Spirit Lake and that's what we see in the fossil record. Let me make sure you understand what you're looking at. There are three people at the bottom of this rock buff. Those are five fossilized trees. But what I want you to make sure you see is those trees are actually going through several different layers. Now, folks, how in the world can you have a tree that starts out, say, in the Carboniferous period, that grows up through the Triassic or the Jurassic period? Fact is, you can. This is one from the state of Tennessee. It's actually a polystrate fossil on the way to Knoxville, Tennessee. And again, if you look very carefully, you'll notice it's growing up through several layers. Here's another one at Joggins, Nova Scotia. Another one growing straight up through different types of rock. Now, here's the problem, folks. According to evolutionists, the rock you're looking at there, they would say that rock is 200 million years old. And the rock above it is 120 million years old, and yet the tree is growing through both of them. How can that be? And this isn't just a once occurrence. We've got these all over the world. In fact, Germany, France, British Isles, Nova Scotia, California, several eastern states, fossils that extend through several layers of sedimentary rock have been found. These are called polystrate fossils. Folks, here's the point. These fossils by themselves completely undo the geologic column. Completely. And yet we keep putting that column in the textbooks. Why? I mean, if we've got physical evidence that completely disproves them, why in the world are we still putting the geologic column in there? The reason is because it builds in time. And if you ask an evolutionist, what is the one thing they got to have lots and lots and lots of? That would be time. In fact, let me show you a page in a textbook that some of you will probably never see because it is a teacher's edition. Notice what I've highlighted. It says stress that the earth is thought to be at least 4.5 billion years old. Well, folks, why would we stress that? Because without that much time, you're not going to be able to get off the ground. All right, so let's think about this for just a minute. Prior to Mount St. Helens, we were not sure how canyons were made. We assumed long time, water, millions of years. We weren't really sure how striatal layers were laid down. We assume long time, millions of years, and then Mount St. Helens happened. And lo and behold, we got a whole new picture. That it not only, it didn't take millions of years. Folks, it didn't even take a year in some cases. You're talking about geologic phenomena that took quite literally just a few days. In fact, let me back up for just a minute and show you something kind of neat. We had somebody with us. Wrong way. We had one of the park folks with us at one point. He explained exactly how this has happened. He said when the lava would come through, basically it acted like a broom. Now, I don't know about all the men in here, most of the ladies in here, you know, you sweep a broom and there's usually a real fine amount of dust that doesn't get picked up and you have to go back and sweep that. Same thing that was happening right here is that lava was coming through. It was actually filtering out layers and it was working just like that broom did. And then the future lava would come in and it would rake it across just like that broom did, laying down all of these fine little bitty layers to what we find today. Let's see. There we go. What I want us to do is I want us to look at some of the skeptics' charges and answer that question, how old is the earth? And in order to do that, I want us to start where they would start. I mean, if you pick up your child's textbook, normally they start with this thing, the Big Bang. They say, hey, this is how we got here. I had a youth minister ask me that very question one time. He said, Brad, is there any way that God could have used a Big Bang to get us to where we are today? Before I answer that particular question, I want us to think about the science side of this thing. Because if you think about it for just a moment, it's horrible science. You know, we've already talked about where in the world did all that stuff for the Big Bang come from? Well, they don't talk about that. What they do is they present a picture just like this one in our kids' textbooks. And they tell them that in 3.4 seconds, everything exploded outwards to the ordered universe. Well, folks, my 8-year-old child is smart enough to realize there's a problem with that. We were driving around in the car one day, and my middle son, Reese, he said, "Dad, that's kind of dumb." I said, "What's that?" He said, "For them to think that you can get an ordered universe from an explosion." And I thought, yeah, my son is getting it. I said, "You're absolutely right, Reese." I said, "Can you imagine what would happen if we took a stick of dynamite, we put that stick of dynamite in your bedroom, and we just blew it up?" He laughed. He said, "Probably wouldn't look any different." Folks, at age 8, he doesn't realize you violated the first two laws of thermodynamics. You've created matter, and you've gone from chaotic explosion to an ordered universe. So how in the world do they explain that? I mean, if we're going to talk about science, how do they explain the very theory for their origins? Let me let one of them tell you. Paul Davies. Here's how he explained it. Evolutionist. He said the Big Bang represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws, the sudden abrupt flash of lawlessness that allowed something to come out of nothing. It represents a true miracle. Now, folks, why is that more scientific than saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth? For you see, when you really start to look at the evidence, and I'm talking about the scientific evidence, this is a miserable theory. For instance, we know that Jupiter is far, far too hot. You say, "Okay, Brad, what does that prove?" Folks, according to the Big Bang theory, that Big Bang happened 18 to 20 billion with a B years ago. Our solar system was put into place approximately 4 to 6 billion years ago. Jupiter should have long cooled off by now. And yet it's giving off twice as much heat as it's receiving from the sun. In fact, we know that NASA has photographed volcanic eruptions on the moons going around Jupiter. In fact, Ganymede, we know, has molten metal inside of it. It's got a magnetic field on it, folks. That tells me that it hasn't cooled off yet. Could somebody tell me how in the world we've got molten metal inside this thing if a Big Bang happened 18 billion years ago? Bob Berman, who is an astronomer, he wrote this warning that was published in the journal Astronomy several years back. He was writing to his fellow astronomers, and he suggested that this warning be placed in front of any article that dealt with the Big Bang. Look at closely at what he says. "Warning: the following contains contemporary cosmology. Reading it can produce disorientation and confusion. Nobody knows what's going on, and nothing you read here is likely to be true." Now, how do we present it in textbooks? That's fact. Let's get back to that question for just a moment. Could God have used the Big Bang to get us to where we are today? Folks, all you really need are the first two verses of God's Word. If you've got your Bibles, go ahead and open them up to Genesis chapter 1. Look with me at verse 1 and 2, where we read, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." Now let's think for just a moment. Do we know the boiling temperature of water, scientifically speaking? Absolutely, depending on which temperature scale you use, it's either 100 or 212. Okay? So we know the boiling temperature of water. Do we also know what allegedly that Big Bang temperature was when it exploded? Yeah, according to evolutionists, that would be in the millions of degrees. How do you go from a million degree explosion to having a water-covered heavenly body on that same day? Folks, you can't. It would have long boiled off, would it not? You add to that the fact the sun, the moon, the stars, what day did they come into the picture? Day 4. And folks, again, you may not like my math, But that doesn't change the fact that God's word says they were here on day four, not before that. So is there any way I can grab hold of the Big Bang and squeeze it into God's word? Not without a whole lot of compromise, folks. And not without perverting the text. And somebody says, well, wait a second, maybe each one of those days was more than just a day. But friends, I'm just going to give you a real quick review of why we know that's not the case. Look with me, Genesis chapter 1. And let's look at verse 5, verse 8, verse 13, verse 19, where Moses records over and over the same phrase. He says, evening and morning were the first day. Evening and morning were the second day. He is putting a punctuation at the end of God's creative activities, defining it as not only an evening and a morning, but he also gives it a numerical adjective. Day one, day two, day three. Now look at what he says in verse 14. Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs, for season, for days, and for years. Folks, if each one of these was not a 24-hour day as you and I recognize it, but rather millions and millions of years, what's he talking about in verse 14? When he specifically says, he mentions three time sources, days, years, and even seasons. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment, and let's add a little common sense to the whole picture. If I were to ask you, what day did God create all the flowering plants on? Oh, see, I always have to look at the kids because kids know. They know the little song, day one. It was on day three, was it not? Day three, God created all of the green flowering plants. Now, if I were to ask you tonight, scientifically speaking, what does it take in order for plants to grow? Well, obviously, you got to have sunlight. You got to have water. And we know that, but let's also look and think. We've also got to have the right atmosphere. We've got to have the right nutrients in the soil. But they also have to be pollinated, don't they? You know those little flying insects that drive us crazy? They serve a purpose. They carry pollen. They allow the plants to reproduce. Folks, when were all the winged insects, all of the winged creatures, period, put on this earth? Day five. Now think about that for just a moment. Are you really ready to take the position that each one of these days was a million years? That means God put all of the flowering plants here on day three. You had to wait 2 million years before they could be pollinated? Folks, that's illogical. You look at Exodus 20, verses 11. Actually, I'm going to just give you a couple of verses to think about. Exodus chapter 20, God handing down the Ten Commandments. Verse 11, he says, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is. 6 days he did it. You then turn to Exodus 31, starting in verse 15, where he begins to talk about what is the punishment for somebody working on the Sabbath. It was to be killed. Why? Because the text tells you, for the Lord created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. So, I mean, do you honestly think that there were two Israelites standing there saying, you know, I really think we ought to work 6 long eons of time? Or do you think they knew I'm to work 6 days and be off on the seventh? Just like God did. Folks, what I'm telling you is, it's time that we get ourselves and it's time that we get our children out of this valley of doubt. We've got plenty of evidence. Let me share some with you. For instance, I suspect most of you in this room have magnets on your refrigerator. Those of you who are grandparents, you probably got pictures of your grandkids. A couple of things we know about magnets. Number one, we know that magnets lose their strength over time. Scientific fact, you cannot disprove it. Number two, we also know that this earth has a magnetic field. You want proof of that? You ask a Boy Scout to hold up a compass. What's it going to point to? Magnetic north. Number three, we know the earth has lost 6% of its magnetism the last 150 years. Scientific fact, you cannot refute it. Well, that tells me something. It's lost 6% of its magnetism the last 150 years. Folks, that tells me this earth can't be billions of years old, or else there'd be no magnetism left. It also tells me that radiocarbon dating that is dependent on uniformity is no good, because this earth is actually changing. It's decaying, so to speak. Or we could talk about the Sahara Desert. We know that every single year the Sahara Desert is growing by roughly a foot every year. It's a process called desertification. In fact, if you look on the screen behind me, you'll notice in yellow, that's where the Sahara Desert used to be. The peach area below is where it is today. The hatched area at the bottom is the direction that it is growing. Again, roughly in round numbers, about a foot a year. But folks, we can extrapolate back from that and we can ask this simple question: how old is the Sahara Desert? The answer is about 4,000 years. And you say, okay, Brad, what does that buy you? Folks, what happened roughly 4,000 years ago that put all of our weather patterns into place? How about a flood? Would that do it? I showed this particular picture for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think it shows part of the problem we have with our educational system today. Number two, it is great proof for a young earth. Let me show you what I mean by that. Teachers who are in here, let me first and foremost say this. If we've got Christian educators in the room, thank you very much, because you're serving on the front line. But they will tell you that we are living in what's called the No Child Left Behind era, which I think realistically is leaving everybody behind. And it is actually teaching our kids not how to learn, but rather how to take standardized tests. Folks, do you realize our children, realistically, they don't know how to learn. What they know how to do is memorize factoids, trivia. And let me show you what I mean by that. Our child reads this page out of a textbook: Mississippi River deposits sediment at a rate of 80,000 tons an hour. You know what he memorizes? Mississippi River, 80,000 tons an hour. He's ready to take the test. But folks, think about it for just a moment. They have lost the ability to critically think about that. If there is 80,000 tons of stuff coming down the Mississippi River every single hour, which there is, then we ought to be able to ask the question, how much further should the delta stretch out if this earth is 4.6 billion years old? And the answer is, there wouldn't be a Gulf of Mexico. It should have long filled in by now. Speaking of that Gulf of Mexico, you know, we know about salt water today. We know the oceans are 3.6% salty. Scientifically speaking, we know exactly where it comes from. We know how fast it's going. It comes from the water cycle. Evaporation goes up, clouds move over land, rain comes down, it picks up salt and minerals from the land, and it deposits them back into the ocean. 3.6% salty. You say, okay, what's the big deal? Folks, using the current models we have right now, and again, you can't really get around the numbers, we could have gone from freshwater to saltwater in less than 5,000 years. Man, that tells me several things. That tells me, number one, the fact that if there was a flood, that would explain the amount of salinity we have in our oceans today. It also tells me that the oceans weren't as salty back when the flood was here, which means fish would have been in basically what you and I might call brackish water. So you'd have freshwater and saltwater fish that could have gone back and forth. Now think about that for just a moment in light of the fact that we know how long it takes. Now, here's another little trivia piece for you. What about oil? I'm a Tennessee boy. Don't know much about oil wells, but I will share one little piece of trivia with you. That one little piece of trivia, those of you who have been to the West Texas Plains, you already know you never, ever, ever stick your hand or your finger over one of those Texas oil caps. The reason is it could very easily blow your finger clean off of your hand, because oil underground in some of those particular wells is being held under pressure at 20,000 pounds per square inch. Now, to give you an idea of how much pressure that is, your car tires right now are inflated to roughly 35 psi, 35 pounds per square inch. This is 20,000. But folks, think with me for just a moment. 20,000 pounds of pressure is a whole lot of pressure pushing up. So we ask the question, how long can oil push upwards through sedimentary rock at that rate? And the answer is less than 10,000 years. You see a pattern here, folks? Do you see a pattern that is continually pointing back towards a younger earth than they're telling us? We got polystrate fossils that completely demolished the geologic column. We got Mount St. Helens that is causing us quite literally to rewrite the whole field of geology. We got evidence after evidence after evidence that proves, you remember what I told you in the first lesson? Man doesn't know a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what God knows. And we used his word to try to figure out how old is this earth. We used 6 Bible verses. And we used those 6 Bible verses to lay down the fact that we could look at Adam's genealogy. And according to the Bible, this earth is roughly, in round numbers, about 6,000 years old. Do you realize I'm now giving you the science to back that up? And while we're talking about oil, where does it come from? This textbook page, take a look at what it says. 2 major fossil fuels are petroleum and natural gas. Formation of these two fuels is not yet fully understood. That is an understatement. They go on to say both are thought to have formed from the decay of organisms that once lived in the sea. The remains of these organisms settled to the seafloor, gradually covered by sediment. After millions of years, the remains were slowly changed by heat and pressure. All right, so they're saying that all of this living stuff was covered over and that that's how we got oil and gas. Now, first off, let me point out, we don't know for sure. In fact, what they used to call fossil fuels, we're not 100% sure that they're really fossil fuels. And the main reason why, 25 years ago, they pumped wells like crazy out in the West Texas Plains, and they basically pumped it dry. You know what they found out about 4 years ago? The oil's back. Now, I don't have to be a mathematician to figure out millions of years haven't passed, but I do know this. Between Midland and Odessa, Texas, they can't build oil wells quick enough. Where'd it come from? They're saying that it came from some massive event, some major event where the ocean covered all of this sediment and it heat and pressure, and they would add millions of years. My question is there another explanation, maybe like a global flood, that would account for some of it? You know, the last time that we were together, we talked briefly about the flood. I want to recall to your mind for just a moment a few things. We're going to review a little bit, but we're going to add a whole lot of new stuff to it. Like, for instance, if somebody asks you, how do we know for sure, was there really a flood? You know, if you go to the 5 highest points on the planet, you know what you're going to find on those high points? How about aquatic fossils? And here's the fun part for me. I love my job. Atheists will send me an email, and I'll send them a picture just like this one. And I'll say, hey, this is a picture from the top of Nepal, one of the mountains. Could you explain to me how that got there? And they always write me back the same thing, local flood. So then I'll send 3 or 4 more pictures from different continents, different mountain ranges, and I'll simply say, hey, how do you explain this? You know what they're stuck saying? Local flood. A local flood that apparently covered 4 or 5 continents, folks. Isn't there a better explanation? And yet, folks, listen to me very carefully. Our society has a major problem with this biblical account. And it's one of those things, I knew it, but I don't think I ever really knew it until about 2 years ago. You know what the reason why our society has such a problem with this? At the root of Noah's flood, do you know what the bottom line is? God is not going to put up with sin. That is the bottom line. And our society doesn't like that. They don't like to be reminded that God is ultimately going to punish sin. And so you know what they do? They poke every kind of thing that you can throw at it. They say that Noah wouldn't have been smart enough. That he wouldn't have had those shipbuilding skills. So we turn in our Bibles to Genesis 2. And lo and behold, you know what we've got? We've got Adam naming animals before Eve is on the scene. We look at Genesis chapter 4. You guys know I'm a timeline guy. We go just a little bit in the future, and lo and behold, in Genesis chapter 4, we already read about them doing things like smelting metal and making musical instruments. For instance, you read about a man named Jubal who was the father of all those who play the harp and the flute. Then it speaks of Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman of bronze and iron. You see, folks, we talked a little bit earlier about two different worldviews. And I told you could have a biblical worldview or you could have a secular worldview. If you've got a biblical worldview, you understand man was created with intelligence. If you've got an evolutionary worldview, you think that we evolved our intelligence after millions and millions of years. Those are two totally different pictures. And as you look at these pictures, you think the fact that the men we just talked about, Jubal, Tubal-Cain, folks realize they are only a few short generations from Adam. So the next time somebody tells you, hey, you know, he couldn't have done it. Noah couldn't have built a boat that big. We just point to modern day phenomenon and we ask, how did they do that? How did they build the pyramids or the Sphinx or Stonehenge? Because the reality is we still don't know. How did they move a 60-ton stone? The leading theory is they used a kite. Folks, I've flown kites before. Never moved a 60-ton stone with one. The best answer I've ever received, and you guys may remember this, I got the best answer I've ever heard from an 8-year-old child. He came up to me during a break. He pulled on my pants. He said, sir, I know how they move those rocks. I leaned over. I said, how's that? He said, they hitched them up to dinosaurs. Then you've got a skeptic who says, hey, it wouldn't have been big enough. The ark would not have held that many animals. In fact, we got members of the church that struggle with this. So you open your Bible to Genesis chapter 6, verse 15, where God gives you the dimensions. He says, this is how you should make it. The length of the ark should be 300 cubits, the width 50 cubits, the height 30 cubits. 300 long, 50 wide, 30 high. Now, a cubit is defined as the length of a man's forearm. In the year 2001, they did a global study, and they determined the average length of a man's forearm was 18.34 inches. If you round that down to 18 inches, that means this boat, it was 450 feet long, a football field and a half. I know there's no football fans in this room, especially no Ohio State or Kentucky fans. Surely there's Vanderbilt fans in this room. Read the very next verse. Genesis chapter 6, verse 16. Listen to what all he commands Noah. He says, I want you to put a window, a cubit from the roof. Now, we've always envisioned a single window. You know what we really believe that was? It was a ventilation window that went all the way around, one cubit from the roof. He then says, I want you to put three decks on it. Now, knowing how much floor space he had, you can calculate volume. And we've done that. And I can tell you tonight, using a very conservative 17.5-inch cubit, he would have had 1.39 million cubic feet of storage space. But since that number is really too big for anybody to remember, let me bring it to you again in a way in which I think you can remember. If we were just to use boxcars as an example, it would take 522 to fill that boat. 522, folks. In fact, if you ever get to San Francisco, let me strongly encourage you, go down to Pier 45 on the wharf of San Francisco. There is a boat docked there. It is going to be docked there, I assume, forever. It's now a museum. It's called the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. It is the last boat of an entire fleet known as the Liberty Ships. I'd heard about it long before I ever got to see it. I called down and talked to a retired Navy man who was manning the booth there at this particular boat. I said, "What can you tell me about the SS Jeremiah O'Brien?" And he began to tell me what year it was constructed. He told me which battles it fought in. And I let the guy talk for 7 or 8 minutes before I finally asked him the one question I wanted to know. I said, "What can you tell me about the size?" Now, bear in mind, he didn't know me from Adam. Didn't know what I do for a living. But the next words out of his mouth were, "Do you own a Bible?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Well, if you'll open it up to Genesis, you can find the dimensions for this boat." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "Yeah, we built the whole fleet to the dimensions of Noah's Ark." I said, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Because we wanted to have large ships that could carry heavy loads through rough seas." Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. Our Navy patterned a blueprint for an entire fleet of ships after Noah, who got his blueprint from Jehovah God. Somebody says, "All right, Brad, where'd all the water come from?" Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. "On that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were open." Last time I was with you, we talked a little bit about this. We're going to actually look at the second portion of this verse. And before we do that, I want to ask a question. Was there really an ice age? Now, I suspect everybody in this room remembers sitting in maybe a history class learning about a land bridge that connected Alaska to Asia. You remember that? And we learned about woolly mammoths and all of this. We learned about the ice age. Now, I just told you that I believe this earth is roughly, in round numbers, about 6,000 years old. How in the world, biblically speaking, do you fit this into it? I mean, the question arises, was there really an ice age? The answer is absolutely yes, there was. Folks, we can't deny it. The reason I say that is because the evidence is incredible. I mean, when those glaciers came down, they would actually carve out U-shaped valleys. They would pick up rocks and sand in their leading edge, and as those glaciers pushed forward and then they finally melted and retreated back, they actually left horseshoe-shaped till mounds, as we call them, where all of the rocks and the stuff in their leading edge was. You can go to Alaska today. You can touch them, folks. I mean, you seriously cannot look at the evidence and say, "Nah, there really wasn't an ice age." So the question is, all right, did it cover the whole earth? Nope. It covered a third, meaning a sixth of the top and a sixth of the bottom. All right, how does it fit in to the Bible? Let's go back to that question. We said, where does all the water come from for the flood? Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. "On that great day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were open." I want you to learn two things from this portion of the text tonight. Number one, it says that things were broken up. Folks, anytime it's talking about something like that, in the context of land masses, you're talking about, quite literally, you're breaking tectonic plates. God is physically ripping tectonic plates apart. But I want you also to notice it talks about it being in the great deep. As you get deeper in the earth's crust, do you get hotter or colder? Hotter, that's where the mantle is. That's where lava is. All right, folks, let's do the simple math. Let's put those together. You've got land masses that are being broke up in the great deep. You're going to have volcanoes going off quite literally all over this planet. Now, I started by showing you a picture of Mount St. Helens. You realize when that volcano exploded, there were people four and five states away that were collecting ash on their cars. 4 to 5 states away from one volcano. I want you to picture in your mind for just a moment multiple volcanoes. Volcanoes going off in the ocean, on the land. What do you get? You get the perfect recipe for an ice age. What do you got to have for an ice age? Number one, you got to have increased evaporation, meaning you got to put more moisture in the air. How do you do that? You warm up the oceans with that lava. But at the same time, this is the tricky part, at the same time, you've got to cool off the land. How do you do that? You block out the sun's rays with the ash. Folks, an ice age that we suspect lasted 350 to 500 years post-flood. Now think with me for just a moment. Here's the cool part. We're post-flood, we're pre-Abraham. Biblically speaking, we are in Genesis chapters 10, 11-ish. We know that people are smart enough to make bricks because the Bible tells us that. In fact, by the way, I would point out something to you. I'm an evidence guy. I love evidence. You remember what Moses, when Moses went to talk to the Pharaoh, what the Pharaoh did as far as what the slaves were making? They were making bricks. He took away their straw. You know what we have in Chicago in a museum up there? We got a brick that has Pharaoh's imprint on it. You know what's in that particular brick? Straw. That's physical evidence. So we know that they were smart enough they could make bricks. You remember what the very next major account in God's word is? We go from the flood, God punishing sin, and all of a sudden they're building up a tower. Here's the cool part. Remember in Genesis chapter 11 verse 8, it says, "The Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth." Folks, that ice age was still in effect. That land bridge that you studied about in history class, it was there. You could have walked quite literally from Europe into Africa, into Asia, down Indonesia, into Australia. You could have walked across that land bridge into North America. There was no Panama Canal, folks. All the way down to the tip of South America. You know, I'm asked the question on occasion, how do you disperse all the animals after the flood? First and foremost, if God is smart enough to get them to the ark, he can certainly disperse them afterwards. But here's part of your answer right here. You want to know how the Mayans and the Aztecs, how they got to this continent? How did the Native Americans get to North America? Here's your answer right here. They get here. They're dispersed. That land bridge eventually does melt. Permafrost goes away. And all of a sudden they're landlocked. Only to be found a few hundred years later by explorers, Vikings. Now folks, think about that for just a moment. It's biblical, it's scientific, and it fits God's word. The problem is we've been hoodwinked into thinking that something really is prehistoric. And we've altered our whole view of time according to that. I'm asking you to go back and to relook at the evidence. To look at the truth. And realize, number one, this book has got to be our guide, first and foremost. Because what we read in here is going to agree with what we see out there. I'm going to stop right there and open it up for your questions. It is 8:35, and we get to worship God tomorrow, so I'll keep this a little bit short. Comments, questions, thoughts? Yes, sir.
I got two things.
Sure.
First,
Yes. No, this is when that layer was actually laid down. So, for instance, from the first yellow line at the bottom down, that was actually laid down from the volcanic eruption May 18, 1980. There was another post-eruption roughly a month later that laid down the next section. And then after that, roughly 2 years later, there was another eruption from the volcano. Does that make sense? No. These were actually, each one of these layers was put in from the volcanic eruption. And the point I'm making, they got photographic evidence of this one spot. They know precisely when each one of these layers came in.
Brother, are you saying that is stone that we're looking at there?
That is sedimentary stone. Which, by the way, if you were to take that stone and you were to analyze it at any university, give it to their geology department, you know what they're going to tell you about that stone? Millions of years old. You know how old that stone is? Top age, 30 years. The guy who did the... Let me get back to this picture and show you something kind of neat. They did a study. If you look at the top right there in the center, you see the new lava dome that's coming up. They went and got some of the rock from that particular lava dome. Now bear in mind, we know exactly when this thing is blowing up, right? So when it produces this lava, this is brand new, fresh stuff. So from an age perspective, that's day zero when it dries and hardens. So Steve Austin actually took some lava dome rock. He analyzed it. He had different labs date it. One lab said it was well over 1.5 million years old. The other one put it over 2 million years old. We knew it wasn't north of 30 years old. Other comments? Yes, sir. Second Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Everybody turn there. Finally, let's see. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord a day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years, this is one day. A lot of people would like to pull that verse out and drop that into the creation week. A couple of things I'll point out to you. Number one, if we did that, you realize you're only buying yourself 6,000 years. Because it's talking about a six-day creation, each day being 1,000 years. You need billions of years. So that doesn't do you a whole much of good. Second, you have just ripped that completely out of context. Because it's not talking anything about creation in 2 Peter chapter 3. What it's actually talking about is when Jesus Christ is coming back. He's saying, look, God doesn't count time the way you do. In fact, God, and this is one of those things we have such a hard time figuring out. God is actually outside of time. He started time. And so he's saying, look, to God, a day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years a day. It doesn't matter to him. But for us to pull that out of context and drop it into creation, it's no good. Now, let me point this out. Can I say that there was a mature creation? Absolutely. And by that I mean this. Did God go and tell Adam, hey, you can eat fruits of any of these trees in the garden except this one? Yeah. What does that mean the trees were already producing? Fruit. Now, here's a cool question. Think about this. He tells Adam on day six, you can eat any fruit. So let's say that Mark and I, we had the pleasure of being there on day six, right before God is about to perform this wedding ceremony. We realize we're like, you know, he is about to do the institution of marriage. We don't want to show up empty-handed because, I mean, this is a wedding. and we're guys, so we're not going to do wet or like china or towels or anything like that. We want to get Adam something cool. So it's got to be electrical or gas powered. So we wrap up a big old chainsaw. And we give it to Adam and he unwraps it and he fires that thing up. He goes out into the garden. He cuts down one of those trees. How many rings would that tree have? Because that tree is only 3 days old. But it's bearing fruit. So was it a mature creation? Yeah. Now, do I think, am I willing to say that God is trying to deceive us with an old look? No, I don't think so at all. God is not a deceiver. But understand that when he put everything into place, it was a mature creation. Do I think that a lot of what we see on this planet, the striatal layers, the rocks, the etc., do I think a lot of that is a result of a global flood that we can't even fathom? Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got, like you said, the next 2 planets. But then until later, day 4, that the heavenly bodies and then the day and night.
Yes. So
I can't quite fathom how you can have water that's not frozen solid and plants without the heat, unless you say.
Okay. Great, great, great question. On day 1, what all did he make? If you look in your Bibles, you've got, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He then goes on in verse 3 to say, let there be, what's the next word? Light. Now, was that the sun? No, because the sun doesn't come around until day 4. So the obvious question is, what is that light? Short answer is, we don't know. Do what now? Could it be the unexplained light in the universe? Maybe. I'll give you a couple of theories that people have proposed. Could it be light energy? Because we know everything is made up of atoms, and maybe that's when God created all the atoms necessary for creation. Possibly. Another possibility, a universal light source, meaning we think locally with our sun and our solar system. And yet God was creating an entire universe. So is it possible that he had a light source allowing him to see the entire universe? Possibly. God is light. Isn't it? I mean, some folks have said, and that was the third possibility, some folks have said, maybe that's Jesus Christ. The point being, there was some kind of light here on day 1. Day 2, what does he do? He separates the waters. You've got a firmament between them. You've got 2 water layers. Day 3, he puts in plants. Now, if we got plants, we're going to need some sunlight pretty quick. So it makes sense to me that the very next day you've got what? You got a sun. So is it possible that the plants may have gone 10, 12 hours without our sun? Yeah. Is it possible the plants went 10 or 12 million years without our sun? No. Yes, sir. Oh, yes.
I mean, are they making comparable studies?
Absolutely. It's probably one of the most researched but less talked about places right now because Mount St. Helens is great evidence for creationists. There are 2 institutions that I'm aware of that are studying it a great deal. Institute for Creation Research out of Texas. There's the Discovery Institute out of California, both of which are very, very involved in active research. One of the cool things, and I say this not as a bragging thing, but so the church can be proud. One of the cool things, when we filmed this DVD, we filmed it in the blast zone. We took 3 high-def cameras, and we had 2 videographers with us. My son and I then went and did the filming. We didn't realize that there's never been a creationist DVD that was shot in the blast zone of Mount St. Helens. And so we now have a lot of creationist folks out there who are wanting this because it's great evidence. It's good stuff shot on location. So, yes, sir.
As young Earth advocates, how do we address the argument made about starlight?
Great question. What about starlight? I mean, you look out there and we're receiving starlight that allegedly left that star so many million light years ago. So how can you say the Earth is 6,000 years old if we're getting starlight from something millions of miles away? Couple of things. Number one, I've already kind of touched on, and that is God created a mature creation. So when Adam and Eve looked out into space on day six, what were they already able to see? Starlight. Number two, very important. You know what we discovered 3 years ago? Something that we thought was a constant is not what? Is not a constant. Let me explain that. On the Earth, the speed of light is a constant. 186,000 miles per second. We use all of our physics to do that. You know what we proved 3 years ago? Outside of our atmosphere, not only is it faster, you know what they think now? They think it might actually be exponentially faster, meaning it speeds up as it goes through time. The other thing to think about is this. If the universe is expanding, which it is, the light that we're seeing today used to be what? Closer. There are, in the back of this book, there's the last chapter, I think. Yeah. Chapter 20 actually talks about starlight and time. And I actually listed out 8 different things that you need to consider when it comes to starlight and time. Some of them are a little more technical than others. Some of them, in order for you to understand, you got to kind of dig in there and understand. But I'm one of those guys, I like to keep it simple. My wife gets on to me if I get it too high up above my head or her head or whoever's head. But the point being, folks, we got plenty of explanations of how we can look out there and see starlight today. Yes. Yeah. Agreed. Very much. Isn't it interesting? The Jewish calendar is basically putting us in that, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 year range when you look at their calendar. Other comments? Yes, sir. That's all right. And like in Genesis 7:11, when it talks about him tearing open the fountains of the great deep. That's all right. Think about it and I'll come back to you, okay? Other thoughts? Yes, sir.
I have a question going back to the flood. Can you give me an estimate on how much water would have fell from the
canopy? Oh, wow. You caught me because I actually skipped ahead. Anytime I get short on time, I always have to kind of gauge that. Let me drop back for just a second. Get you to think about something. We know that God would have had to give Noah clearance. We call that the draft of a boat, how deeply it sits in the water. Anybody in here that's a fisherman, you know, if you're running across a lake, let's say you're running wide open. If your depth finder says 35 feet and then it all of a sudden goes to like 3 inches, what does that mean? It means your prop just left. So God would have had to have given Noah clearance above the mountaintops. Now, if you look at the boats on the thing, you'll see one is a speedboat. It's not going to need very much clearance because it's moving quickly. The other one, if you got, say, an ocean-worthy vessel that needs to be able to stand up to those pounding waves and keep from capsizing. If you ask a shipbuilder, what is the draft of a boat like that? He'll tell you it's a half the height. Meaning that boat has to settle into the water one half of its own height. Okay? We remember the dimensions from Genesis chapter 6, verse 15. It's 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide by 30 cubits high. Okay, that means it's going to settle into the water one half of its height. One half of 30 is 15 cubits, right? So God has got to give him 15 cubits of clearance. Now, take your Bible and read with me. Genesis chapter 7, starting in verse 18. Where it says, the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth. The ark moved about on the surface of the waters. The waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. God knew precisely how much water he had to place on those mountaintops. 15 cubits. Now, let's take the next step. Somebody says, okay, Brad, where'd all the water go? Because this ties into what you just asked me. Where'd all the water go? Number one, we know that a lot of it went up into our atmosphere. God caused a wind to come and blew a lot of it into our atmosphere. That's number one. Number two, we know some of it is below our feet in a water table, right? Trillions of gallons above your head, below your feet. Number three, turn with me to Psalm 104. Psalm 104, starting in verse 5. Talking about God, it says, you who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. I think it's the American Standard. It's got the best rendering of verse 8. It says, you stretched the mountains up. You pulled the valleys down to the place which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. After the flood, God apparently changed the topography of the earth. Pulled the mountains up, stretched the valleys down to accommodate some of the water. So back to his question for just a moment. I get asked, how do you get water over Mount Everest? Well, folks, according to the text, Mount Everest was probably not as tall as it is today. Because part of the way that God accommodated some of the water is he pulled the mountain ranges up, he pulled the valleys down to the place which he set for them so that the water wouldn't come and return and cover the earth again. So bottom line is God, yeah, were there mountains before the flood? Yeah. Were they as high as they are today? I don't think so. I think the text tells us that. And I think God put 15 cubits over the tall mountains to allow for that boat. Do I know how many gallons that is? No. If I knew that, I was going to say I wouldn't have to work anymore, but I work for a nonprofit work at the church. I'll be working until I die. Other thoughts, comments? All right, man, you guys are going to let me off easy. Tomorrow morning at 9:45, we're going to be right back here. I know that we don't steal sheep in the church, but since I don't know what flock you belong to, I expect to see you. 9:45, and then again, we will worship at 10:45. 10:45, we're going to be looking at a medical examination of the crucifixion. I hope that you will make plans to be with us, to worship with us tomorrow morning. I'm going to throw out two pitches just because I've had several of you already ask me about the stuff out there. The first pitch is this. Please take home with you this magazine. It is free. It is a monthly magazine. It is produced by faithful Christians. I'm a little biased, but I think it's the best one going right now. We're excited because we were able to get this in Barnes & Noble and a lot of the secular bookstores. It's competing against things like Newsweek and Time Now. That's something to be excited about. There's a sign-up sheet out there. You don't have to pay a dime. You sign your name on it tonight, and they'll send you a bill. It is only $30 a year, folks. There are a lot of you that drink a lot more coffee than that. So if you can give up one cup of coffee a month, then you can bring this into your house. The second thing, a lot of you have said, hey, where can I get that timeline or where can I get some of the stuff? If I were going to recommend a single item, it would be this book. I poured my life into this book. This is a 20-chapter book. It is full color for those of you who like pictures. It covers everything that we're talking about as far as all the age of the earth stuff, Christian evidence stuff. It's in here. All of Noah's Ark, the Ice Age, et cetera, et cetera. For those of you who don't read, you're not going to be left out either because there is a DVD version. Some of you said, hey, is there a thing out there that's got all your slides and stuff on it? We went into a studio and filmed for that reason. If you are studying with somebody, if you're about to send your child off to college, at least look through it, flip through it, because that's what I wrote it for, was to give people the evidence of why we believe what we believe. Thank you very much for your attention tonight.